Hi, I'm Femi Oke. In this 9/11 legacy episode of The Stream, it's an opportunity for you to comment and also analyse the impact of 9/11 globally. If you're on Twitter, at AJStream is our Twitter handle. If you're on YouTube, well, the comment section is right here for you. You can comment live, and hopefully your comments, your questions, I'll be able to get them into as much of the show as possible, and you can be part of today's discussion.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen. It may include dramatic strikes visible on TV, and covert operations, secret even in success. Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Let's meet the guests who are going to be analyzing what happened since that conversation from George W. Bush 20 years ago. Hello, Kimberly. Hello, Maha. Hello, Mohsin. So good to have you on today's legacy show, talking about 9/11. Maha, will you introduce yourself to our audience? Tell them who you are, what you do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show. My name is Dr. Maha Hilal, and I am co-director of Justice for Muslims Collective, also author of the forthcoming book, Innocent Until Muslim, Islamophobia, the War on Terror, and the Muslim Experience Since 9/11.
It's a weighty thing being an author. Congratulations. Looking forward to your book. Mohsin, welcome to the stream. Introduce yourself to our international audience.
Thank you. My name is Mohsin Dawar, and I am a member of National Assembly of Pakistan, and I represent North Waziristan. And I'm central chairman of the National Democratic Movement. And I also am the founding member of the Pashtun Tahafuz Movement.
Kimberly Halkett, Washington, D.C., correspondent from Al Jazeera English. Okay, 20 years ago, where were you? This is one of those moments where people say, where were you? Do you remember? And of course, the answer has got to be, for many of us, yes.
Yeah, I remember it vividly. I was 9 months pregnant. I live on Capitol Hill, and I had just moved to the United States, and people were running outside my window, and I couldn't quite figure out why, nor could I join them, because I was so pregnant. And so for me, the fact that that baby I was pregnant with is now 20 years old, or turning 20 years old, really crystallizes for me the impact of this. It's one generation, and I remember the terror feeling, where have I moved to? What is going on? It was like nothing I'd ever experienced.
I'm just thinking about what President Bush said 20 years ago, Maha. And even at the time, the extent of what the US was declaring war on seemed so huge. How could that even be possible? Now, 20 years later, we are so much wiser. Maha, thoughts? The war on terror.
Absolutely. So I'm glad you actually started with that clip, because I think if we start thinking about why we are where we are today, the Bush speech is a perfect reason for that. And he essentially talked about this, quote, war on terror, as one that would be endless, boundless, would include all sorts of tactics, right? It would allow the United States to treat the whole world as a battlefield, as the AUMF that he signed did. And so I think it was a really critical speech, right? Because it laid out basically the blueprint of this war on terror, right? And the blueprint was essentially that we're going to do whatever we want to do in service of theoretically combating the terrorist threat, which, as we know, is impossible to do. And especially because the United States refuses to examine and reflect on its own role in causing global conflict and massive violence all around the world.
Kimberly, you're nodding. Mohsin, I'm going to bring you in just a moment. Kimberly, just articulate the nod.
Well, I think there were so many aspects to that that I agree with. The fact that it's not over is certainly very true. And I think even I sort of the word terrorist, that under the U.S. definition can be just about anything. And I think the thing that came to mind in all of that is prior to the September 11th attacks, I didn't know what the word hubris meant. I suddenly understood it, and I saw the impact of that by the United States' war on terror that goes into sovereign nations to get the so-called terrorists, which could be anyone that opposes the United States. It really was not only violating human rights, but also international law in many cases. And so Americans, and particularly the leaders, were looking at and saying, why do people hate Americans? Why are we experiencing these attacks? Not recognizing that when you go into these nations uninvited and invade or try to nation build when nobody asks for that, that in fact, you're going to have these blowback effects.
I'm just looking here at my laptop, Mohsin. There's an article that we tweeted out about, has the war on terror been a total failure? I'm just going to scroll down here to this comment about our conversation today. And it says, yes, because the US and those who participate in the invasion of Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria are the real terrorists. If you start listing some of the things that the US military has done over the 20 years, and you don't put a title on whose military or whose soldiers actually did that action, it might be quite difficult to know if they were good guys and they were bad guys in a war. It's difficult anyway. Mohsin, thoughts?
Thank you so much. I think the clip of President Bush, which you played in the start of the program, and this clip very much concludes the whole debate of war on terror. Like the way he said that either you are with us or you are with the terrorist. Now, after 20 years of war, everybody knows that who stood with the terrorists at the end. Like the way at the end of their withdrawal, the war on terror and the jihad, they merged with each other. And the way it was said in the very start, that we will not stop until the war will not over until each and every terrorist group is stopped. But you know what we have seen at the end is that the people against whom a bounty of almost 10 million and 5 million and many other amounts were announced, they ended up in the cabinet of Afghanistan. And the U.S. And the rest of the world, they remained silent spectators.
20 years ago, a Mauritanian citizen called Mahmoud Oud Salahi was scooped up, and he was taken from Mauritania to various different countries, and he ended up in Guantanamo Bay. He was detained for 15 years and then released with no charge. I know you all know his story. He spoke to us just a few hours ago, and this was his contribution to our analysis of what happened. What's the legacy of 9/11? Here he is.
After the tragic events of 9/11, I was kidnapped from my home country and rendered to Jordan, Afghanistan, and then in Guantanamo Bay. I spent in all 15 years. I lost my mother, and I lost my brother while in prison. I was subjected to different techniques of torture. I was sexually assaulted. I was beaten badly. And I spent the vast majority of my time in prison. Accountability means that I face the people who tortured me and that I have a chance for a public hearing where can I address my grievances. But whether that happens or doesn't, I forgive everyone.
He's such a remarkable man, Maha. Is there a place for forgiveness? Is there a need for forgiveness in a war situation? Thoughts?
You know, I feel a little hesitant to answer that because I think forgiveness is a question for those who have suffered directly from the U.S.'s state violence. And, you know, I speak to Mohamedou frequently. He's a friend of mine. And I have heard firsthand how much pain and suffering he has endured, not just at Guantanamo, but after he was released from Guantanamo. And I think accountability is really important, as he said. And one thing that bears mentioning is that when prisoners at Guantanamo are released, right, they're transferred, right, they're cleared for release. They're not vindicated. The U.S. government doesn't say, oh, we're sorry, we detained you without charge and tortured you. There's none of that. And essentially, a lot of them are either sent to a third-party country or their home country, where the U.S. basically abandons them, and they are left to fend for themselves. After all that time in detention and torture, experiencing the worst violence, war crimes, by the hands of the U.S. government, they are just left. They're just thrown away. And we have to bear in mind, right, there is a global climate of Islamophobia. Islamophobia doesn't end in the United States, obviously, right? Not only is it part and parcel of the U.S.'s war on terror, it has been adapted as other countries' war on terror to fight this, quote, threat of terrorism. And one thing I just want to add to this is, you know, I had written an op-ed actually in Al Jazeera about the question of moral equivalence. And it was based on Ilhan Omar's comment a few months ago about getting justice and, you know, for the victims, also for, you know, the crimes that the U.S. government has committed, Israel, Afghanistan, and she said, you know, the Taliban. And what's really important about that is because of the way terrorism is constructed as inherently more evil, inherently more violent, and somehow less moral than state violence. Of course, state violence, as it's used by states, right, is supposed to be morally superior. In 2006, Bush said something along the lines of, you know, I can't entertain that we're anything like those terrorists because they kill women and children. How many women and children has the United States killed? And so the problem is when the United States considers its violence more moral and just moral in general, it allows it to justify and legitimize massive state violence.
Okay. Maham, I'm going to share the conversation with you, with your co-panelists. Kimberly, go ahead.
Well, I fully agree. I mean, and this was to the point I was making earlier, is that what we've seen the war on terror do by the United States going in with, you know, murdering with impunity, is we've seen the rise of other types of extremist groups. For example, in Iraq, we saw the rise of Islamic State. And the United States continues, even as Joe Biden has just said that Afghanistan has wrapped up. It hasn't wrapped up, because what's still going are the drone strikes that have been killing not just the so-called terrorists, which, by the way, you know, never had a trial, were never properly charged, were never afforded the rights that the U.S. Constitution affords to American citizens, just killed with impunity, almost like an extrajudicial killing. You know, this is the kind of thing that the United States and Anthony Blinken has said, look at our foreign policy moving forward is going to be with a foundation of human rights. Yet we're seeing this continuation vis-a-vis the war on terror, where that is not the case, and this killing with impunity continues.
Mohsin, we have some thoughts and comments on YouTube. I'm going to put one of them to you. Thank you for watching on YouTube. This is Thor. Thor says, the real question is the response to the 9/11 attacks. What were the consequences and ramifications of invading Afghanistan and Iraq? Excuse me. Mohsin, from your perspective, how would you answer Thor?
Well, I think the way, as I said in the start also, the way this war on terror started, I think in the situation in which it started and in the situation in which it ended, I think the way it ended is more worse than the situation in which it was started. Because, you know, there is no doubt that Taliban were ruling Afghanistan before 9/11. And that was also not an elected government. They came by force. They took over, they were, imposing violence and the same kind of human rights violations on the people of Afghanistan. But there was still a hope amongst the people of Afghanistan that there might come some point and somebody might come for our help and who can take us out of this situation. But after 20 years, the way it was handed over again to Taliban, I think in itself negates the actual meaning of a war on terror. And it has, the way the Afghans were abandoned, the way they were thrown to the wolves. And I think the situation this time is more frustrating and worse than the one which was in the start, because at this time, the Afghans, they have seen that the entire that the U.S. and all their allies, they have abandoned us. They have handed us over to Taliban. And the most alarming thing, the dilemma at this time is they do not have any hope left for the future, because who else gonna come to rescue them?
Well, and I think it's important to note, too, though, I just want to jump in. You said the way it ended, it didn't end. I mean, the CIA is still operating in there, and Joe Biden said that this hunt for terrorists will still be in not only that region, but in other regions around the world. So I think that's the biggest concern, is that there is no end to this. And the United States has said that they will strike at the time and place of their choosing in retaliation to the murders of the Marines that were at the Kabul airport. We've seen one strike already, but is there going to be another one in Afghanistan? We simply don't know. So that's the problem, is that this language continues to be exactly what it isn't. It's misrepresenting and trying to normalize or even sort of pacify the public. And I think it's really important to note, too, we haven't talked domestically about the impact of the war on terror, but Americans for a long time have not had an appetite for this conflict that continues. They have spent trillions of dollars, and there's this feeling that they know not only are they being hated for it, but that they can't afford it. When American tax dollars, it's really easy to say, but all of those names have faces. These are single mothers that are working multiple jobs. These are police officers that are underpaid, and as a result, that's having blowback in the United States with poorly trained and selected officers. The impacts and the ripple effects go on and on and on.
So, Kimberly, if I may, we've got Liz Rainey, who's on YouTube, and she kind of was ahead of you in that thought. Liz says, I was 11 when the attacks happened. Since then, I've lost more and more faith in the government, just constant war and surveillance. I want to take us in another direction. Obviously, still talking about the legacy of 9/11. The cost of war. Stephanie Saville has actually researched it. This is what she told us a little bit earlier.
President Biden and others are claiming that the forever war is over now that U.S. troops have withdrawn from Afghanistan, but it's not. I've put together a map that shows that there are 85 countries in which the U.S. engaged in counterterror operations between 2018 and 2020. Oftentimes, far from the innocuous help that it sounds, it arms authoritarian regimes to crackdown on political opponents newly renamed as terrorists. We as Americans need to question whether this vast expanse of military activity is protecting Americans and others around the world, and or if it's not, what should we be doing instead?
I have to show you this on my laptop because I was stunned. 2020 U.S. defense spending compared to other countries. Here's the U.S. Here are Australia, Italy, South Korea, Japan, France, Germany, Saudi Arabia, United Kingdom, Russia, India, China. That is an immense amount of money. Mm-hmm.
It's money that means that seniors are going without the drugs that they might need to treat diabetes. Children are not getting cared for. The education in the United States is sorely lacking in many states. All of that money that people believe when they work hard and they give their tax dollars over is then being taken by the government. I think it's really important to also note in all of this that one of the reasons this is not going to end is because the United States has a long history with the military-industrial complex of making money. This is an industry. The United States needs wars to fight. And if it doesn't have wars, then the people that are working for these enormous security contracting companies are not making the millions and billions that they count on. And they owe it to their shareholders. And so they need a new conflict. And that's why this war on terror might leave Afghanistan, although we still know there are people operating there, but it's going other places.
It is so rare, guests, when we're doing a show where we're asking you to analyze an issue, a situation, for everybody to pretty much come at the end of it and just say, well, that was a disaster. It's very rare to have that agreement. I want to bring in another voice. This is Mustafa. And Mustafa, if he was looking for a silver lining, I think he may kind of have it just a little bit. I don't know. Let's have a listen.
The legacy of the global war on terror has complicated and ultimately made for a much more decentralized extremist landscape. We are no longer living in the same world that we were living in 20 years ago. And it goes without saying that the mistakes and missteps have only added ammunition to the extremist toolbox that exists and has always existed. We must return to resurrecting and defending the human rights principles that we have always stood by. If we allow securitized approaches to loom paramount over basic human rights, we have fundamentally lost the global war on terror.
So I took away a positive idea about, okay, this is where the U.S. goes forward. But Mohsin, from you, what next? What do we do now as a world, hopefully learning the lessons of the reality of a war on terror? Just very briefly, because I'm going to go to each of you. You've got a minute.
Well, I think there is hardly anything which we can do. The only thing we can do is to condemn and raise the voice the way we have been doing it since long. And I agree with one of my colleagues when she said that it hasn't over yet. And I know, I believe that it might extend. State has been handed over to some terrorist groups. And now it will affect the entire region.
Okay.
And I think this is something which the U.S. wants. And the way they fought an ideological war against the erstwhile Soviet Union, this time I think they want, instead of containing an ideology, they want to contain an economic expansion of the regional power. And for that very purpose, they have once again...
All right, listen, I'm going to share the close of the show with your fellow co-panelists. We hear you. I hear the point you're making very clearly. Maha, briefly.
Well, I have to say I'm not sure at what point in history was the United States upholding human rights principles. I mean, from the inception of this country, it was founded on, as we all know, genocide and the enslavement of African peoples. So this country has never actually adhered to human rights principles, has never espoused them, has never actually implemented them within the country. So I think we need to very critically push back against that narrative.
Right.
And I think the last thing we'll say is, you know, there's a lot of talks and discussions and panels right now about the lessons of the war on terror and the post 9/11 climate. And I want to know, what lesson is the U.S. government actually learning?
Right. What are they learning? That is a cue for Kimberly Halkett if I ever heard one.
I think that we haven't really touched on the impacts domestically and very quickly, the sprawling surveillance state and the fact that we have two people that were courageous enough to expose the sort of the worst aspects of the war on terror. Edward Snowden, who exposed the spying of domestic spying that takes place in the United States, and also Julian Assange, who exposed the Abu Ghraib and other abuses. And they are still being persecuted by the U.S. government as a result of that.
Kimberly, Maha, and Mohsin, And everybody watching and following on YouTube, on Twitter, thank you very much for being part of today's show. I'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.